The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Richard Boyatzis. Richard is a distinguished university professor at Case Western Reserve University and an adjunct professor at Izadeh Business School. He is the co-author of Primal Leadership, Resonant Leadership, and Becoming a Resonant Leader. He has a new book with co-authors Melvin Smith and Ellen Van Oosten. It's called Helping People Change, Coaching with Compassion for Lifelong Learning and Growth. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kelly.
I was initially attracted to this book because I had read some of your emotional intelligence work with Daniel Goleman. And I'm fascinated with evidence-based approaches to behavior change. But what ended up giving me a number of aha moments while reading this book was the fact that I suspect most people have a very incomplete understanding of what coaching is, certainly from sort of an evidence-based background. And you write in the book, quote, unlike mentoring, which can sometimes last over decades, coaching typically involves a shorter time period and a more specific focus. And there's more to it than that that makes it different too.
That's right. And in fact, we're using coaching not as the separate activity, but including all forms of helping. So we wrote the book with examples in it, equally for managers trying to develop subordinates, for people doing more formal coaching, as well as physicians and nurses helping patients, teachers helping students, and even parents working with children. So we're using coaching in a more generic sense. Now, that said, everything that we've studied has been in the process of either looking at helping or coaching, and you're right. I started this work in 1967, but we really ramped up the work with the behavioral studies and the neuroimaging studies and the hormonal studies starting about 30 years ago. So it is a joy for us to finally have amassed enough published research in academic journals, which means it, you know, stands the test of scrutiny and all that kind of stuff, and be able to say, yes, there are some better ways to go about helping someone be open to change or learning. And sadly, there are a whole bunch of ways that close people down.
Yeah.
And, you know, all too often, although meaning well, people fall into those less effective ways.
Yeah, well, and that's business as a whole, right? I mean, there's so many aspects of the way we conduct our business which are contrary to the things we know about greater performance. And one of the things that's interesting, too, about that word coaching, just from my world in improvisation, is that that's the term they use a lot for the teachers, that they aren't so much teachers as they are coaches. And one of the things that you learn when you are coaching improvisation is it's not about your vision. It's about tapping the vision of the ensemble that's in front of you and the individual in front of you to get the greatest expression of his or herself. And that's where the great stuff gets created from.
That's ideal. I mean, that is a perfect example, as well as a good analogy, if not a metaphor, for the whole process. Because when you're trying to inspire improv, you're trying to inspire people to open themselves up and let it flow.
Yeah.
And that requires, you know, whether you knew it explicitly or not, it requires tapping into a particular neural network, and it requires tapping into a particular affect and a particular hormonal system. And I know it sounds really hard, you know, odd that it's also mechanical. But if we think about another way, what are the mechanisms by which a person feels free and open and is willing to consider new ideas? Well, that's in this state. And what we were trying to do in all the research, and found a lot of pretty compelling evidence, and in the book, we tried to write the stories. So it's really, it's more emotional appeal, but we referenced the research so that people could always look it up if they wanted it. But we're really saying, look, the way you're going to catch this is to read the stories. But the point is quite simple, and it's exactly what you just said. If you want to help somebody change, don't do the usual thing about tell them what to do, because they go into a defensive mode and they close down. So if you sat in front of a cast or an ensemble mm-hmm. and said, be creative.
Right.
Right. That's right.
Yeah.
It's not going to go anywhere.
Nope. Nope. So I want to key in first on this idea around personal vision, because that has that could sound very sort of airy-fairy. It could sound, but you root this in the evidence and even fMRI studies. And one that I thought was fascinating was where you talked about like spending 30 minutes in a conversation about a person's vision or their dream. It activates regions of the brain that are actually associated with joy, gratitude, curiosity. So, yep. I mean, talk to us about that. That's amazing.
Okay, so it starts with a very interesting observation that when you decide that the context of a conversation is going to be a problem, you know, whether you're going to a coach or you're going to a counselor or you're going to your boss or your spouse or partner and you say, hey, I've got this problem. I want to talk about the problem. What tends to happen? The person tends to wallow in the muck and the mire of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And what most people don't appreciate is talking about it doesn't tend to make you feel better about it. It tends to get you sunk further into it. So the observation that letting the context for a conversation be a problem is a negative context is not surprising or shocking. The thing that most people really erroneously consider is they think by tackling a problem, you're going to solve it. Well, you may address the problem, but your ability to be creative about it, to be open to possibilities, is dramatically reduced. Because the research says when you activate this analytic network in the brain, yes, you can solve problems, you can make decisions, but you're closed to new ideas.
Mm-hmm.
You actually are closed to scanning the environment.
Mm-hmm.
So how would somebody think of something? And very often in organizations, we hear a lot of, well, that's not the way we do it here. We can't do it that way. It's not invented here. And even in strategy levels, it leads to something called competition neglect, where you know, you keep doing what you're doing, thinking you're fantastic, and your competition passes you by. Well, what we showed was that instead of framing it in terms of this negative and activating this particular network, if you frame it in terms of the possibilities. Now, you are correct in saying that we spent a lot of time in the book talking about one way to activate this is to have people talk about their dreams. It turns out, I mean, I'm an author back in 1970 of an article that said, setting a specific goal will help you change more.
Mm.
By 1999, I had to say, I was wrong.
Right.
Even though I proved it, I was proving something that was better than nothing, but it wasn't as good as this alternative. And it turns out the alternative is to talk about the dream, not the goals.
But there
are other emotions. Now, why does that work? I think it works because it activates a sense of hope. There are other emotions that activate these psychophysiological processes. You just mentioned one of them, which is gratitude. So we have an exercise that we use where we say, who helped you the most in your life? Talk about them. Talk about some moments with them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've done that exercise in like 65 countries. And no matter where you are, in Astana, Kazakhstan, or Milano, or Cleveland, people answer it in an almost identical way. And when they talk about the feelings that it conjures up, they are all of the feelings associated with this more open state, which, again, is not just open emotionally. It also has been shown in repeated studies to be where you are the most cognitively advanced. You can be the most creative. You can handle the most complex ideas. and you're open to other people. So the combination of activating these things is very powerful. But let me throw a couple others in, because although we didn't spend a lot of time focusing on it, we did mention it. And one of them that's very important to improv is playfulness.
Yeah.
And it turns out that playfulness, feeling joyful and laughing, activates this same psychophysiological state. So it's one of the reasons why, and because when humans are around each other, unless you have some degree of Asperger's or autism spectrum disorder, which means you really have trouble connecting through this empathic network, but you know, the 99.4% of the rest of the people in the world, or 98.4% of the people, pick up emotions from others around them. And, you know, Joseph Ledoux showed that it happens in 8 to 40 thousandths of a second. And that emotional contagion works positively or negatively. Well, it turns out that when you start to feel this hope through vision, or gratitude through compassion, or playfulness through humor, other people pick it up.
There's a million things I want to try to connect up. I'm going to try to do a few. One is, we actually have an improvisation for autism program, because improvisation is recreating human behavior and the practice. So we get a lot. It's a lot of kids, but adults too, who come in, are allowed to recreate human behavior, and the patterns we've seen, and there's been studies on it too, is that especially in the hours following class, the folks on that spectrum are able to sort of communicate more effectively, laugh more easily, pick up on cues.
That makes a lot of sense. It fits with research I knew back when I was a therapist about how severely autistic children could be brought to communicate through music, through playing music.
Mm-hmm. Very similar thing. And then the other thing I thought of when we talk about sort of emanating from the problem not being a problem, I think of like Danny Kahneman, and someone who sees the world as a problem, but he does that with joy. And I remember I was on, my wife and I were teaching at Stanford, and our friend Tina Seelig, we're talking to her out in the beautiful quad area, and she was doing research on luck. And Anne, my wife, says, oh, Kelly is the luckiest person at like finding parking spaces. He can always find a parking space. And she goes, okay, what I know about Kelly and what I know about my research is that it's not so much that he is lucky at finding the space, it's that he's assuming there's a space for him. He's not seeing it as a problem, or that it's a problem to be solved, and that's part of the game of it.
That's true, but it's also possible, Kelly, that you're one with the universe.
I know that's not true. if that were the case. Okay, so much cool stuff in there. One of the things, so you have the section on the five discoveries. And quite frankly, like, to me, I was like, oh, I could just talk to you about this. But I definitely, there's other things I want to talk to you about. But I found this a very compelling area, because it really sets kind of a roadmap for understanding the journey one might go through in a coaching scenario to get someone from point A to whatever their point Z, you know, is. Because we're looking, the difference here with this book is we're not looking at a behavior change that is for, you know, the next few days. You're talking about sustained behavior change.
That's right. That, in fact, is the most telling issue, because almost everybody, I mean, look at New Year's Eve resolutions.
Right.
I mean, people who run health clubs love it. You know, people sign up, and, you know, they go for a few weeks, and then they have their membership dues for the whole year, but nobody shows up anymore. And it's the sustainability. Look, any effort at learning or change activates some degree of stress, and it's tough. So what keeps you going? Well, our sense is that for many people, it is this deeper sense of purpose that we call a vision. It's a part of feeling, yes, the dream. And by the way, people in organizations who are really good at inspiring others to keep going, even at horrendous paces of work, end up activating and talking about the sense of purpose. And I've noted that in some of my graduate student groups who've studied, for example, the writing teams at Saturday Night Live, talked about, the documented things from the, you know, interviews and all that, is that first 10-year segment in Saturday Night Live, they had a different quality of interactions. And the producer kind of, you know, gave them the reins at various moments. Mm-hmm. And that was very different than the next 10 years.
Yep.
So, you know, you see this in a lot of places. And, you know, part of it's that. Part of it's this sense of gratitude. One of the things that's very much a part of the positive psychology movement is the role importance of optimism, which I agree is important. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as your friend said in the quad, it's that you don't think that the obstacle is going to be there, so you trust it. And chances are just degrees of randomness are in your favor.
Yeah.
Because my guess is you don't do that in those places like downtown Chicago where there are very few meters. And so the issue of optimism is very powerful. Well, Sonia Lobrowski, who's a senior faculty member at UC, I think San Bernardino, has done a lot of studies on that. And she used to have people writing in optimism journals. And she did this for, you know, like 7-year-olds, 10-year-olds, 16-year-olds, 30-year-olds. And then she found that the more they did, if they did 15 minutes every day, it increased their sense of well-being. Then it came to her that what about gratitude? So she had an experiment where she had a control condition, then she had people writing an optimism journal, and she had other people writing a gratitude journal. Well, the optimism dramatically increased the sense of well-being over time compared to nothing. The gratitude doubled the impact of the optimism.
Wow.
So part of why we wrote this book is I just felt, you know, we're exposed to rampant narcissism in our society right now. I mean, actually, I wanted to call chapter 10, Get Over Yourself, but
yeah.
My co-author said it's too negative. Uh-huh. You know, but look, what's the dominant form of photography today? Selfie.
Selfie.
So we are narcissistic beyond belief. And when you add that to the fact that in terms of values, people have gotten very self-righteous. And I'm talking about the entire spectrum. I'm not talking about any particular group. And by the way, I see the same dynamics in every country I've been in, you know, a number of them in the last 6 months. So how do you get out of that? Well, you know, I have a whole bunch of friends who feel, well, you have to meditate, you have to go inside. You know, I also think, my parents immigrated from Greece. I come from a Greek culture, very interpersonal. I actually think caring for others is another way to get there.
My buddy Nick Epley at the University of Chicago once said to me, if you want to put yourself in a good mood, do something nice for someone else.
Right. That's right. Well, and it turns out there really is scientific evidence now of why that happens.
Yep.
So it's not just, as you said, it's not just hairy-fairy stuff. Mm-hmm. This really works. Now, the thing that's awkward is that we're designed in most organizations to think that we have to be social engineers and that we have to fix things. Mm. So all of a sudden, we become, you know, like the classic in-laws telling you how to dress your kids. And the fact is that people don't want that. Mm. And when you're in a professional role, when you're in a service role, when you're in any role or job that requires you to adapt or deal with people, and then let's leap all the way to the creative ones that you were talking about, with improv and other forms of creative expression, you really want people to open up. And that's where we don't do it. We have the opposite effect. Even though you're well-intentioned, when you tell somebody how they could do something to do something better, unless they genuinely asked you for that help at that moment, which most people don't genuinely ask for, they're shutting down. And what we're talking about is how to help people open up.
Yeah, it's interesting that I think both in the performing arts, which we've mentioned a couple times, but also in sports, there's a keen understanding that your great performance comes from practice, practice, failure, practice, failure, practice. And even, I always talk about this when I go out and give speeches, like the most elite hitters in baseball are failing 70% of the time. So,
that's right.
You know,
right. I mean, Babe Ruth hit more home runs than anybody else, you know, until Maris, but he also had a lousy batting average.
Yeah.
So part of it is this, odd notion about how we think we might move somebody else. And it's just, it's too punitive. And
right.
It just doesn't work.
Right.
So it helps to explain why the actual durable impact of education, treatment adherence for most maladies is abysmal.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because physicians and nurses try to scare the hell out of you.
Yep.
And, you know, then you also have even not just education, but in training programs or other things, people often wonder, well, you know, why aren't people doing what I showed them to do because it's so much smarter? Because you did it in a way which, even though you meant well, closed them down.
Yeah, and we just had Marcus Buckingham on, who talked about this the lie at work around well-roundedness, and that if all your salespeople just followed the same script, you know, everyone would be selling well. Which just denies the fact that every human being is completely different, both as a seller and the person they're, you know, who's buying.
Well, plus the fact is that nobody buys something from somebody that they think isn't being genuine.
Right, right.
And we even have a role. We call them used car salesmen, which you know, may not be fair to all used car salesmen. But I remember my wife and I trying to buy a car, and this was maybe 40 years ago, from somebody who said, I've only sold new cars. I have never sold used cars, as if that was establishing his credibility.
Yeah, I just had a deal with like a new car situation, and I think it's all car salesmen, but that's my bias. So you have a very interesting thing in these five discoveries, and the first of which is the ideal self. And I thought this was very, very interesting because you talk about a lot of times people will confuse that with an ought self.
That's right.
So talk to us about that.
We grow up in the context of expectations of other people. Max Weber actually said we grow up in the iron cage of other people's expectations.
Mm.
So what happens is, and then as we start to get older, we want to be a part of certain groups, and very often belonging or aspiring to belong to certain groups means that as a part of that identification, we take on whatever their social expectations are. And at the extreme, you know, you have wanting to be like the cool kids in high school, but that continues throughout our lives.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens? All of a sudden, you start trying to act like somebody else, and that's not authentic. And when you're then interacting with other people, people don't feel that it's genuine. And you don't feel that good about it. That's what we call the ought self. You're acting in a way that other people have told you you ought to act.
Mm.
Now, they may not tell you directly, but they may tell you by their behavior or the values in the organization. And then you end up kind of doing something that just doesn't work. I mean, a classic example of that in radio was Good Morning Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where all of a sudden, you know, I mean, the character that Ron Williams plays, who was modeled after a real fellow,
mm-hmm.
you know, kind of does exactly the opposite of what he's told, and he breaks all sorts of molds. You know, he's not serious, he's joking, he uses music, he criticizes, he parodies, and people love it. In part, they love it because it's funny. In part, they love it because it's genuine, and it's speaking to their emotions. So a lot of what we're talking about is, you know, in some way, it's very simply human
mm-hmm.
to say being, I know it sounds sometimes gushy, but being genuine is very important. Well, the ought self is never genuine. Now, the thing that we have to be careful of is some cultures have more of a sense of hierarchy in terms of the value systems, and those cultures very often respect authority.
Mm-hmm.
So their ought self is done out of a sense of obligation. And you see this in certain Asian cultures. And not just this, some of the Mediterranean and Middle Eastern. There it gets complicated because very often when those people are in other countries, we get them when they're 40 entering an executive MBA program or some management course. And they're saying, you know, I've been an engineer all my life. I did it because my parents told me I should be an engineer. I don't like being an engineer. Or, you know, I don't want to be a dentist anymore. So what happens is they eventually come to grips with the fact that they really don't want to do it. But by then it feels too late. And if they don't, if they aren't in an environment which allows them to make modifications, they feel trapped, and that's when the human spirit diminishes, if not dies. And any sense of openness or creativity just goes out the window. And when people aren't open, they're defensive. And when people are defensive, they, you know, one of the things that defensive people do is they immediately judge others and, you know, sometimes go on the attack when, in fact, that's the last thing you want to do.
It's interesting you brought up Robin Williams in that particular role. My wife is a comedy professor, and so she talks a lot with her students about the when you are crafting your persona, if you're doing stand-up in particular,
right.
You have to signal to this audience who you are as a way for them to relate to the comedy. And you actually bring this up in the book as a study that self-deprecating comedy has there's studies around the fact that
right.
that's very successful. And indeed it is, because you sort of bared your truth. And one of the things that I thought was fascinating that you talk about is when you're talking about yourself, it's not just how you see yourself or your ideal self or even your real self. The way you show up in the world is also how other people see you. That is if not equally as important, just as important, right? Yeah.
Well, one of the reasons why the self-deprecating humor, I think, comes across so well, it involves a certain vulnerability
yep.
and humility.
Yep.
And one of the reasons, well, Fabio Sala is the psychologist who did that as his doctoral dissertation at Boston University. And what I thought was brilliant was when he showed that effective managers use more humor, but the type of humor they used was more self-deprecating
yes.
or self-referent, is because you think about those comedians who attack others.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the, Don Rickles, Lenny Bruce.
Yep.
We might call it edgy, but it's not comfortable.
No, and this, so over the last couple of years, I've been interviewed a lot about whether Trump is funny or not. And I'm like, and I would contend that he is, but he is using humor as a bludgeon. I mean, he's using it to separate and create out-groups, whereas people who are more giving and I think more creative are using humor to create in-groups.
Because that's a consequence of one set of his behaviors, especially yeah. in his tweets. And his way of labeling people as a way to kind of, I think, artificially juice up stuff. What happens is when he does say something in a humorous tone or, you know, tongue in cheek kind of thing, nobody takes it that way.
Yeah, it doesn't
or
play.
They don't get it.
Yeah.
And that gets him in trouble. I mean, so, you know, I don't know. I saw this repeated again, but I saw it first 2 years ago when somebody said Democrats take. Oh, no, Republicans take Donald Trump seriously, but not literally.
Right.
Democrats take him literally, but not seriously.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the things that happens is, you know, when you act in a certain way that is either offensive or, you know, just seems wrong, then when you do say something that's humorous, that, you know, even if it's self-deprecating humor, people don't catch it because nobody's expecting it or believes it.
There's a story in the book that kind of broke my heart. Happy ending, but it's about this kid who was in his third week of kindergarten, and the teacher had him draw a picture
yeah.
of a house in an airplane. Yeah, tell us about that.
Well, he's in kindergarten, and the teacher asks all the children to draw a picture. I think the first one was of a house.
Yep.
And you know, a lot of the kids draw pictures that. You know, have a box house and they try to put a tree in front and a mommy and daddy stick figure. And he draws a picture of vertical lines in clusters and then horizontal lines in clusters. And then they go on to say, okay, now let's draw a picture of an airplane. And everybody draws, you know, kind of lousy pictures of a fuselage and wings, but, you know, you can kind of get what it is. And he again draws, you know, horizontal slanted lines and some, you know, at another angle. And, The teacher talks to the counselors, talks to the principal. Now, there's some other stuff going on. You know, they feel like he's, you know, not being cooperative in class.
Mm-hmm.
And they feel like he's isolating himself. So they put this all together and they say, there's some emotional problems here. Now, we don't know why, but there are emotional problems. So they decide that he should be put in a special class, in special ed. They call the parents in and tell them, and the parents are shocked because at home he's a normal kid.
Yep.
And he plays with friends, and nothing of this shows up. And the father, who happened to be an internal consultant at a large, you know, company, and you know, has been trained in some of these things, you know, starts to talk about it, starts to argue about it. But of course, whatever the parents say sounds defensive. Yeah. Well, little did they know that the school decided this was the case.
Mm.
So he was out. So they come home feeling quite angry, dejected, and they walk in the door, and Aaron's there, and he sees his pictures in their hands. And he's, oh, you have my pictures. And I can't remember whether his father or his mother said, but yeah, yes, we did. And isn't that great? So they sat down right away on the couch, and they put the pictures on the table in front of them. And the father turned to Aaron and said, Aaron, what do you see there? What did you draw? And he looked at the picture of the house, and he said, well, these, and he's pointing to the vertical lines, these are the plumbing lines for the toilets and the sinks and the water. And then he goes to the horizontal. He said, these are the electrical lines so people can plug things in on each of the floors.
Mm-hmm.
Then his father pointed to the airplane. He said, these are the hydraulic lines to control the wings, and these are the fuel lines, the ones that went across where the wings would have been. So here's a kid who is at minimum a burgeoning engineer, at maximum an architect or designer,
yeah,
who, because nobody asked him what he saw, they jumped to the assumption. Oh, look, as a clinician, when somebody draws a picture that seems so out of context of what others do, it's one of the signals that you say, well, is there some kind of emotional schizophrenia or something else going on? Now, when you add that to the fact that the teacher didn't say that he's left-handed and she's been trying to force him to write with his right hand, so that had got him upset with her, mm-hmm. he resisted her, mm-hmm. and he got sullen in class, so he quieted down, and the kid was five. So you add all those things together, and the only, as you said, the sad thing was it took them 3 years to get him back into normal school. And I picked up on that. Because I thought it was a classic example of not focusing in on what the other person means or wants. Later on in the book, we come back to all these different levels of listening, which a lot of people have heard before, but I just thought this was a more poignant example of how, you know, we often jump to conclusions, and instead of asking the person, and this is what I was saying as a former CEO of a consulting company and as a, you know, an executive or administrator here at the university, a number of different groups over the years, you know, one of the most powerful things you can do is ask somebody what they really look forward to, you know, in the longer time horizon. And if you know what a person's dreams are, I remember in the 90s, some top executives from some companies were saying to me, you know, we can't do that. We can't ask people their dreams. Suppose their dream is that they don't want to work here. I looked at them and I said, then they're not now.
Yeah, yeah.
So the question is, if you know a person's dreams, you're going to be a lot better at finding an opportunity that might move them closer to their dreams. And most of the time, people don't really want to move organizations. I mean, actually, Marcus Buckingham was the one who quoted in his first big book, that people often, the research shows that people often leave managers, they don't leave organizations.
Right, right.
So a lot of this ends up being, again, counterintuitive from common practice, because common practice is defensive. And when you're defensive, you're not open. And when you're not open, you're neither funny nor creative nor healthy. Because the same process we're talking about here that helps people be open also activates our immune system.
Right.
And I didn't mention that, but it's very important, because part of that state is activating what's called neurogenesis, which is stem cells in the adult human brain. Stem cells from your hippocampus and your olfactory lobe can become new neurons. And we need to replace neurons. Thousands of them die every day. So we have to replace them. The problem is that if you're in a stress state, annoying stress. I'm not talking about acute, even chronic, but annoying stress of, you know, cell phone doesn't work, your computer is slow, you know, that kind of stuff. You're caught in traffic. Those things pile up and stop neurogenesis.
Mm-hmm.
They stop your brain's ability to create new neurons. And we need them.
Yeah. The thing about that story, too, with this sort of, you know, ask them, talk to them, find out what you know, ask questions. We have a program with the Center for Decision Research at Chicago Booth called the Second Science Project, which looks at behavioral science through the lens of improvisation. So we create a number of exercises to get at the evidence. And one of the studies that we developed an exercise for was this idea that people don't think other people want to hear personal details about themselves, but in fact, when they do, they make quicker discoveries and faster bonds. And so the exercise we do is we have someone describe universally how people grocery shop. And it's kind of boring or whatever. And then we have the next person say how you grocery shop, which is always quirky and weird. And it always people start laughing. They're like, I learned so much about you because I do that too. And we're like, okay, so that's a benign situation. Just imagine if we did that with the things that were important in our lives.
Yeah. No, I think that is brilliant. And it's so much more effective, Kelly, than saying to people, oh, you want to be more creative, open up, eat more fiber.
Yeah, right, right.
The idea is, you know, talking about things that are common, mm-hmm. in common and sense of shared, talking about things that are quote-unquote normal, and self-disclosure. I mean, when I was in training as a therapist, one of the things that they pointed out is you don't want to make it about you because, right. you know, the session all that's about the other person. But periodically, there's a moment in which if you share something or reveal something about yourself, some self-disclosure, it makes the other person feel comfortable. They don't feel that they're on as much risk.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's a lot of it is this emotional contagion. What happens when you're doing stand up or you're doing improv and you've got a cold audience?
Right.
It's you know, not, there's all of nothing. A sudden, every muscle in your body is constricting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're sweating, and it's terrible for everyone. All right. The way we end the podcast every week is we ask our guests for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, when groups of people are making something out of nothing, they get nowhere by saying no. And they can't even just stop at yes. They have to say yes and. They have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten the idea. And I'm wondering if you have a yes and story for us.
I have a lot of them.
Good.
Give me a theme.
So I've been thinking a lot about what you talk about in the book around resonant relationships and connection and how easy it is for us to, especially when things are hard, to isolate ourselves. And putting ourselves out there is really, really hard. But ultimately, most of the time when we do it, it ends up feeling good. And I imagine that's something that you've run across in your world.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yes, and I mean, a classic moment I remember this was with my high school physics teacher. He got a bunch of us that wanted, and he said, you know, you want to take a second year of physics. Max Boyson. This is in Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, six of us were very nerdy. Five of us ended up going to MIT. That's how nerdy we were.
Yes.
But we said, yes, let's do a second year of physics. So he said, okay, we're going to do all the original experiments of the great physicists. So, you know, we spent the summer cleaning up a basement room so it could be our laboratory and painting it and all that. And he bought some equipment. So the first big project in September is to calculate the gravitational constant that Sir Isaac Newton found.
Hmm.
So we do the whole, we read up on the stuff. We do the experiment as he talked about it. We come up with this calculation. We present it to Mr. Boyson. And by the fourth decimal point, our number is different.
Mm-hmm.
And here is this typical moment, and what he does is he looks at us and he says, you know, I've told you that sometimes naive observers in science come up with some real breakthroughs.
Hmm.
He said, you may be onto something here.
Hmm.
He said, but I've also told you that science looks at replication as a way to increase confidence. He said, so this is what I'll do. Let's hold off on the next study, and I want you over the next 2 weeks to redo this one.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, I'll call a physicist I know at Columbia, and I'll call a professor, and I'll call another physicist I know at Brookhaven National Labs, and I'll set up two meetings with them. and we'll take a trip and we'll go to each of them and you'll present your findings from the two studies and we'll start to see what they think.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we charged into that thing. We couldn't wait to get down to the basement of that building and work on that because, you know, here we had a chance to add value to something that Sir Isaac Newton did.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, so we're so excited. We collect all our data and damn, we found the same numbers as the textbook said.
Mm-hmm.
So we reported to him that we must have done something wrong the first time. And he said, okay, so now let's move on to the next experiment. I remember that, and actually I've talked to some of my classmates around our 53 reunion. We were chatting about part of this with one of the guys, because it fired our curiosity, and it made us feel that we weren't just dumb kids.
Mm-hmm.
We might have happened onto something really profound. And for those 2 weeks, our curiosity made us feel like we were, you know, the Avengers.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's the kind of effect I wish I have more often as a professor or an advisor. I wished I had when my son was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of moment of social interaction, if you want to put a label on it, or interacting with another person in which you feel great because somebody reached out and helped you consider possibilities.
I love it. The book is called Helping People Change. Richard Boyatzis, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Kelly.
Getting the SAN is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survive. From the culture, no one survives.